Hello everyone, very pleased to be with you all. I want to thank the Mosaic Rooms team, of course, for organizing everything for us tonight. And an even warm welcome to my very dear colleagues, Maud and Fatima Zahra, who came straight from Rabat, Morocco, where they live and work. I think it's, of course, worth mentioning that they live and produce their research or all the activities they have, so mainly based in Morocco, of course, because as we will be addressing issues of the writing of art history or the production of a system of knowledge, let's say, around archives rooted in North Africa and in Morocco, it's worth mentioning that these two talented researchers who come together in order to publish this book that I am happy to be the publisher of are pretty much grounded in the field. So tonight we will be listening to Maud and Fatima Zahra, who very kindly prepared a kind of summary or overview of the research behind this book, and God knows on how many issues and different questions you can approach the Casablanca Art School, which is a very wide subject and complex network of protagonists. So I guess I should be also mentioning a few names in this introduction, just for the setup of these main protagonists composing what we call the Casablanca Art School, before I pass on to my colleagues. But first, I would like also to mention a few other projects and venues where the Casablanca Art School artists and archives can be presented in the current days. There is much curatorial activity and academic research over the Casablanca Art School, which has been also highlighted, is currently highlighted in different cities, which I will mention as one of the main crossroads of, let's say, southern modernities. So one of them is a project to which Maud has been contributing, which is the Bauhaus Imaginista project happening in Berlin, Sao Paulo, and Bern, where Maud has been and is working as a research curator for the chapter of the Casablanca Art School in the wider Bauhaus Imaginista project. And you can also find essays by Maud and Fatima Zahra on Bauhaus Imaginista website, if you just Google it. Another project will be one of the other Berlin venues happening next October in Stuttgart. IFA Stuttgart, where one of our colleagues, also working for the book we're discussing tonight, Salma Lahlou, who is another talented researcher and curator from Morocco, will be a co-curator among a quite long list of co-curators for the Stuttgart project that also looks at the Bauhaus non-Western heritage and reception, I guess. I also mention an exhibition curated by Fatima Zahra at the Mohammed VI Museum of Modern and Contemporary Art in Rabat of another Moroccan pioneer, Ahmed Sharkawi, a very important retrospective curated by her last year, which is also somehow connected to the Casablanca Art School issues from a wider perspective. So just before, again, I pass on to my colleagues, I wanted to make a few points clear about the main protagonists and the historical figures we're discussing, talking about the Casablanca Art School, mainly between the mid-60s and mid-70s, let's say, if I want to be broad, but it's a kind of parenthesis, again, within a much larger history of a school or an infrastructure that pre-existed to the artist we're referring to, who by the mid-60s would actually open a new chapter for that school, but you could even say a parenthesis, because it's not even sure that the tremendous innovations and transformation made by those artists between the 60s and the 70s were actually followed up during the 80s, 90s, until nowadays. It's actually unlikely and not the case. So it remains somehow as a parenthesis, or almost as a school within a school, if we want to take it as a more macro historical perspective anyway. So this protagonist for the main visual artist involved were obviously Mohamed Melehi, who is the subject of this exhibition here, with a clear focus on his artworks, among the other ones. So obviously tonight Mohamed Melehi will not be the focus, but will be relocated in a more complex group of people. Then Farid Belkahia, who actually happened to be the director of the Casablanca Art School, a very young director of the Casablanca Art School by 1962, and who would be the one to bring over people like Mohamed Melehi. So Farid Belkahia was himself a renowned Moroccan artist who also claimed for wider African or Berber artistic roots, and traveled between Paris and Prague in a quite intense third worldist and anti-imperialist period of time, post-World War II. And so these three figures, completed by Mohamed Sheba, the third main figure of this group, who was also educated between Morocco and the West, for instance, in Rome, had a much more probably theoretical program, maybe, than Melehi and Belkahia. So each of them also had their specificities, and also producing something spectacular when coming together, as we will go over with the two presentations. And two other protagonists who really have to be mentioned, but will be much better explained by my colleagues, are the two more anthropological or theoretical figures of the school, who actually gathered, raised, and produced a whole body of knowledge around the rediscovery of Berber craft and tradition, and how the visual artists from the school were about to use those sources, or to transform those sources. And these two figures are Tony Maraini, who is an Italian art critic and anthropologist, and Bert Flint, who was a Dutch anthropologist and African art collector. But it's enough for me as an introduction. Already said a lot, so I will pass it on to Fatima Zahra first, who will refer mainly to issues of working with the craft, working with a set of, so to speak, traditional material, and we will see how to problematize this notion of tradition and modernity. So thank you, Fatima Zahra.
Thank you. I usually have a small voice when I'm stressed out. If you hear me well, it means that I'm pretty okay tonight, which I wish.
Is it
otherwise,
on?
I don't even know if it's on.
Take this one.
No? Okay.
For now.
So, not being a very fluent English speaker, I'll be reading if you don't mind. I just wanted to say something about the idea of a group within a group that Morad introduced earlier. Thinking about this presentation and how we would actually give a glimpse of what we've been doing and what we've been going through, trying to understand the narratives within the history of School of Casablanca, We decided to start with the exhibition of 1968, as a date that indicates many things, or it harnesses different histories within the bigger history of the School of Casablanca. And it reveals also issues associated with pedagogy and transmission, but also issues related to art in the public space and collaborations with Tony Marini and Bert Flint that Mourad referred to earlier. 68 was also the culmination of everything the group has set since 64, the date not when Belkahia was director, but when Melihi and the group of teachers gathered around him. Everything they said since 64 concerning the problem of artistic heritage and its role in modern art practices as well as in collective visual education. Because it's the moment when Bert Flint introduces Melihi and Tony Marini to pictorial traditions in mosques and zawiyas of South Morocco that included paintings on wood like the ceilings in the region of Tagoundeft, which Melihi got inspiration from while he did his ceiling that we can see
You can see the ceiling on the photo, for example, here, the fragment.
But even in his work.
And, his work is all over the place.
Ouais. Non, mais le plafond spécifiquement.
It's in room 3.
Okay. Which was a major discovery that will have actually a tremendous impact, both on the artistic but also on the educational practices within the school. 68 also indicates a critical moment in the history of the school because it's the arrival of new members, Mohamed Hamidi, Mustafa Hafid, and Mohamed Romain Atala, three artists who also had artistic trajectories in Europe. And the three of them were involved with Melihi, Shabaan, Belkahia in exhibitions in public space, such as Jamal Fna, Marrakesh in 69, but also in Casablanca in 69, and Maud will tell more about that. So we can see here, obviously,
so that's the beginning of slides for the 1968 exhibition, which is, I guess, one of the biggest discoveries, because we were pretty excited when finding this out about this collective and experimental exhibition of 1968, where the professors would come together with the students to create something quite outstanding. Can we know more about this?
Yes. It was the idea, actually, of Mohamed Shba, who joined the members of the core group, was Shba, Belkahia, and Melihi. But when he arrived in the school in 66, he was in charge of the graphic arts studio and interior design studio. So he had the idea of doing a sort of global art installation, mixing all the works together in an integrated vision of art within the architecture. I'm not going to speak about the location because it's something that Maud will discuss, but I just wanted to stress on a specificity of this exhibition. It's that it undertakes the synthesis of architecture, art, and traditional arts. It shows the results of 4 years of educational and artistic reform, which corresponds to the first promotion of students who studied multiple practices within the school. We had photography and painting in the studio of Melihi.
So here we actually can see photography combined with painting, sorry.
Right.
It's exactly what you were saying, the combination of photography with painting.
Exactly. But also the technique of fresco, Hamidi coming from l'École des Beaux-Arts de Paris, brought with him the technique of fresco that he learned with Ojan. We had also ceramic, and that was a workshop inherited from the previous version of the school, which was under the protectorate.
And here again we can see the ceramics on the shelves in a kind of, again, spatial combination with different layers of wall paintings and frescoes.
And it was a very hard picture. At first we only knew the first picture, actually, and we spent like months trying to understand what it was. We knew where it was, we hardly knew who was involved, but thanks to the archival material found like 3 months ago or so, we entered the physical space, and now we can actually imagine how it was inside and how complex it is, even for us now to pinpoint each and every practice, to to try to figure out where it came from, which workshop, knowing that in 67 works from artists as well as students really merged, so we have this iconography that is very hard to dismantle. My cousin is in the audience, could you help him? Thank you. So a few words about the educational reform, because this exhibition also shows those 4 years of practicing. So the educational reform was supported by a program based on the complementary value of theoretical lessons and formal experimentation. And the program emphasized studying and reappropriating popular and traditional artistic heritage, as well as rehabilitating the figure of artist-artisan, in keeping with both the national artistic tradition and Bauhaus principles. The term popular arts, rural and urban, designated a wide spectrum of artist production, basketry, carpet weaving, textiles and jewelry, produced by a set of manual skills that by the mid-20th century were disappearing. So the valorization of secular artistic traditions embodies an ideal of reunification of the so-called artisanal production and the artistic one, which artists of School of Casablanca consider as a possible solution to the social and cultural problems of post-independence Morocco. It also indicates a major change in attitudes towards traditional, popular, and rural arts, which implies undertaken inventory and study of artists' productions that were born in rural region and geographies that were unknown at that time, even for the artists coming, for the Moroccan artists coming back to Morocco. So it's also important to stress, because it's Bert Flint who actually, from 65 to 67, institute a return to tradition through numerous expeditions and field research trips conducted at the roots of Moroccan material culture. Thanks to his itineraries, he came to Morocco around 55, and he was absolutely passionate with rural arts.
Just for a second, to go over the layout that we're looking at, which is actually preparations for the book, even though they're still quite raw and simple, because it's under process that we allow you to see in our kitchen for cooking this book. But what's interesting here is that we tried, you know, to gather enough capacity, or I should even say funding, to be able not only to reproduce the archive per se, but actually go back to Bert Flint, who is still alive nowadays, living in his own self-made museum of African and Berber arts in Musée Tixiouine in Marrakech, and where Fatima Zahra and Maud, among several interviews that they conducted for this book, as you can imagine, with as many ex-students and professors of the school as possible, could actually go back to Bert Flint. And what shows this photograph is that they even hired a professional photographer to actually record by new photographies the present condition of all these objects still in possession of Bert Flint.
Mm-hmm. No, it's totally true. Yes, so all this program of rehabilitating the artisan and the revaloration of the traditions, rural, popular, were theorized and presented in the Maghreb Art, which is a publication of the school that existed in 3 issues only, and that was conceived at first as a communication tool, but also a pedagogical tool that was meant to be given out to students, but also to public and audiences that come to the school, because the issue of communication was very much present at the time. The school was unknown, and they would, there's a dimension, a manifesto dimension to each and every action of this group. And it's, we can see it in publications and actions in the public sphere. So Maghreb Art was first under the authority of Bert Flint. It was his initiative, having the idea of constituting a museum because he was really obsessed with the idea of collecting, but also to give a frame, a museographic frame to his collection. And L'École des Beaux-Arts de Casa was such a platform for him at first. So the first number is under the authority of Berfin, but what he called at that time le bulletin le Centre Marocain pour la Recherche Esthétique et Philosophique, Moroccan Center for Research, Aesthetic and Philosophical Research in Marrakech. And doing so by collecting and also giving that frame, Bert Flint's works paves the way for an anthropology of the object and of material culture in Morocco since the beginning of the 60s, and even before he knew Melihi and the Casablanca group. And Melihi actually brought him to the school to impulse that research on material culture. So we can really speak about a material turn, both in practices, but also in history, also on analysis approaches. His analysis and field works propose genealogies which open up possibilities for a dialogue between art history and the history of material culture. He thus offers the opportunity to the artists of School of Casablanca to trace the origins of Moroccan artist modernity back to Maghreb's artistic traditions. Bertrand researches find their match in theoretical concerns of the art historian and anthropologist Tony Marini, who is also interested in the material history of the works and the sociology of knowledges and techniques which make their creation possible. Maghreb Art, which is the magazine, states the outcome of their respective research and analysis. The review shows the first attempt to structure a new area of knowledge which lays between artistic and pedagogical experimentation, anthropology, material culture, and art history. Since the beginning of the 60s, Marini has been introducing a questioning of the material object, the relations between art objects, creeds, and beliefs. Her approach aims at safeguarding the delicate articulation between formal and material analysis of the works in their social and historical context. And both of their approaches embody an attempt at pluridisciplinarity that has its effect on the method, a method that will oscillate during the Maghreb Art moment between two approaches which at some point sort of unfold one against another.
Between
Bert Flint and Tony Marini, yes. Bert Flint has a specific approach to the object which is focused on symbolism of interlife, of forms and shapes in a way evolutionist somehow, and sometimes even essentialist, because what he tries to shed light on is really the life of shapes, of forms, and the significations. He started his collections with jewelry, interested in the shapes and archetypes of jewelry, and then he extended it to other forms and productions, such as the small sculptures that are made in the tradition of oil lamps. And here we have a very important planche, I don't know how to say.
Plate,
thank you. Probably the diapositive before. Okay, this one. Page 27. We should all know the page by heart, because we can see a fibula, so coming from his jewelry collection, with a triangle, and there's the shape of the woman giving birth, and we can see the lamp, the little sculpture made with... So the sculpture made in the tradition of oil lamps that go back to Neolithic. And fibula is probably an antique, but the sculpture is contemporary to Bert Flint at that time and to this number, actually, or the years before. And he went on expeditions to find the artisan that made that work. And he based his theory on the fact that the transformation, the internal transformation of the object led to a tulatorian object, to an autonomous sculpture, because we don't see it here, but then this artist came to do like statuaire, vertical sculptures. So we don't see the lamp from upside, like this, but the sculpture stands up and there is a figure. Qu'est-ce que je peux dire ici par rapport au... Yeah? Do you have a question?
Do you want Do you want to move on to Maghreb? Do you want maybe to... Maybe we should mention this photo here, right? Because after everything you just explained, this is a very interesting and a very intriguing document on which something that you suspected, because you have told me about it several times, even by old, during the time we didn't have so much archive as we have today, that there will be some
black and white picture,
exactly,
barely visible,
exactly, that now we have this kind of proof that for how the carpet was integrated within the school's atelier. Here, for example, in Mohamed Melehi's atelier, where I remember from our talk last week, he would mention the fact that he would want to remove the Greco-Roman chests and sculpture often found in the school's atelier, and to replace that template of Western academism with a singular carpet for its inherent qualities. Can you just tell us how did it feel when you saw this, and to what thought did you reach?
Two ideas come to my mind now. Is the fact that first, within his exhibition in 65 at Bab Arwah, Melihi, after receiving bad comments from the audience, like maybe a couple of days after the opening of the exhibition, people would assimilate his work to something coming from the West, something that's formalist, that's a bit too far from Moroccan culture. And he asked Bertrand to bring that carpet to actually educate the gaze and to make people see how close the formal language was between those two productions. And to see the carpet within the space of the studio with those works that are very interesting. I mean, there's wavery, there's a mix of both technique but also iconography. At the moment that Melihi himself described as a laboratory for both students and artists, they were learning at once. They were receiving that material culture and all those informations from traditional and secular artistic heritage at the same moment, not with the same prism and probably theoretical tools, but they were sort of experimenting those materials in the same moment. So there is something that's very contemporary to the experience between artists, professors and students.
No, as you say, again, there are like very clear methodologies, for example, here of turning the pictorial space into a space which is now interacting with a weaved pattern or a you know, something that basically is not meant to be shown or experienced as a sheer painting, right? It's a different experience to look at a carpet. And so the influence of these craft objects around them, as if they could contaminate the way of working, the way of thinking, the way of inhabiting the space of the school, is obviously something very much surprising and exciting, on which we have to reflect over and over, I guess.
One last thing maybe about the discovery of the ceilings, which we can find since number 2, the issue number 2. It's 66. Even before, actually, that's what's tricky.
Okay.
Even in 66.
In issue number 2 here.
In issue number 2, which is autumn 66, we can see that Bertrand's picture at Ouattara. That's a picture of a ceiling that you can see also on the wall here in the exhibition. So even at that time, Bertrand had discovered those painted ceilings. But it's not up until 68 that he goes with Tony Mahini and Bert and Melihi to take photographs and to prepare the third number. Yes, and the third number has a specificity. It is that it doesn't contain any text, neither from Tony Mahini nor Bertrand. I forgot to tell you, but the two numbers, the two issues, 2 and 3, are under the authority of the School of Casablanca, and the third number, Bertrand, does not exist anymore within the space of the publication for many reasons, but still we do have his pictures here, and they decided not to have text but only to have iconographical material for the education of the gays. And what I wanted to say is that at that point, before those experimentation, at that point, artists, and especially Melihi, found the argument to prove that modern practices could be like directly linked to these productions. And until and since that moment, they it was the final proof. I don't know how to say it, but they got a bit disinterested, and it was it. Like they had the material proof because it was ceiling, so plain surface, because it was pictorial, same as painting. It was a bit futuristic. We don't see it in the pictures, but there is a bird that's crossing all the composition. All the colors were bold. All the vocabulary, ornamental vocabulary, was specific and neat, and they gave them all the tools to actually experiment and try things like this that we can see. So a work of translation, of transposition between artistic genres, registers, but also between different temporalities.
So what we see here are experiments, graphic experiments done by students, right?
Yes, coming from studios of Melihi and Shana, and knowing that at that point, 67, 68, both Melihi and Shana did classes of graphic design. So someone like Hariri, who was a student at Shana's workshop, could go to Melihi's and study graphic design and then go back to Shabazz and do interior design or work with him at his studio, Studio Casson, really working in publicity field and in a very integrated and, integrated art, applied art.
Sorry, so do we have more images from that? So we can see some of them are still linked to calligraphy, mm-hmm. Some of them are quite more emancipated as, you know, overall optical, mm-hmm. geometric, but also textual, because calligraphy, I guess, would mm-hmm. always remain more or less there, you know, either you go for total abstraction or more transformative kind of scriptures, which I guess is mainly based on the Kufic, which is the geometric calligraphic pattern.
The thought in motion. It's really about translating and giving formal physicality to this act of translating avant-garde and tradition.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much, Fatima Zahra, for all these very precious arguments and ideas. I propose, since Fatima Zahra focused by the end of her speech on the painted ceilings that the group of Casablanca will begin to rediscover by their explorations in forgotten rural zones of the Great South of Morocco, but also around Marrakech. I propose that we look at a very short 3-minute film clip, another great discovery that we made during the process preparing for this exhibition and the book, is a film that was produced in 1984 by the time Mohamed Melihi had a solo exhibition at the Bronx Museum of the Arts, in New York, and the Bronx Museum had the great idea to produce a documentary about Mohamed Melihi's practice, which you can watch entirely in room 3 on the screen downstairs. We just have a short clip now of these painted ceiling experience and Melihi himself explaining through the voiceover. I hope we will be set up with sound. So we will, thanks to the film, come into those places that we used to look only through, upside-down photographs, mm-hmm. looking at the ceilings, only through documents, still documents.
High Atlas Mountains, the Tarudat area. Isolation of these parts has conservation or has played a role of preservation of these sites. These painted ceilings in modest and humble mosques were kept out of reach of the new modern invasion. As you may observe, the architecture is very simple, made of adobe, mud, and the ceilings were painted as to symbolize maybe a certain devotion to the cult place.
This is the bird.
Fortunately, these places are still kept, not because of interest, they are kept in the spirit of being forgotten. The particular thing about these paintings struck my eye because they are familiar to me, because my way of painting, my discourse of painting is very close to these ceilings, and I've never seen them before. So when we saw them the first time, I felt concerned about this work. Maybe another painter wouldn't give any importance to this realization and would consider them like any decorative work. But the important thing about this sort of writing, you know, in the absence of reading and fluently speaking language, these ceilings are pieces of literature. You can say from the diversity and the richness of the patterns and forms, and sometimes they speak to you, and they are, I would say, inspired from nature, because this artist lived in a complete natural atmosphere without any contact with the modern or official civilization in the urban areas. And this is the big merit of these works, and certain wisdom, and the convergence between this expression and what we might find in modern art today. So we meet here again the mystical feeling. And sometimes you would read a small sentence devoted to the worship of God.
Okay, very inspiring clip. And now we can come back to this, of course, in the discussion afterwards. And now, following Fatima Zahra, we're very lucky to listen to Maud. Thank you very much. We'll address issues of public space and experiments by the protagonists of the school with an expanded and at least counter museum strategies, using the streets but also using other kind of social spaces, as we will see.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Maura. Thank you. I think I will start again with the annual student exhibition in 68.
Right.
Yeah, that is so important for our book.
And also because you've been also interviewing a lot of ex-students, so you're actually able to tell us about some of these works who were done by whom, right?
So this annual student exhibition has been organized outside the walls of the Casablanca School and was aimed to be directed to the public arena, even if the event has gathered actually a small audience. So this limited impact with the audience will encourage the artist teachers to, 2 years later, organize exhibition directly on the street. So this annual student exhibition took place at La Coupole, which is in English the Dome, a small colonial construction built in 1917 under the protectorate, the French protectorate, in the Arab League Park, which is located just in actually in front of the school. So this building, this small building, is inspired by a traditional architecture of a marabout, which is a funeral monument dedicated to a saint, a marabout, and that is yet reflecting the colonial gaze on traditional local architecture and was used to promote the French power in the public and the urban sectors. So So La Coupole, this dome, has been actually rehabilitated by the Casablanca School, who actually find the building in a very poor situation, with the administrative support of the municipality, because the municipality was also supporting the school for their pedagogical activities. And Farid Belkaya was actually close to the municipality, in contact with them. And this dome was used for exhibitions. And in 1967, the first exhibition organized at La Coupole was an exhibition organized by Bert Flint called Form and Symbol, with the support of the school, inaugurated the venue as a way to embody the steps of the school. So as Fatim Zahra said, and Mourad also, Bert Flint joined the Casablanca School in 1965, so quite in the beginning of the leadership of Farid Belkaya, after he met Mohamed Meleri, that he actually know since the 50s, so they were very young when they met in Tanger, that invited him to the school. His knowledge of the rural region at that time and his collection of artifacts whom production is endangered make him a strong asset among the group. Bert Flint will create a museal frame for those objects took shape in 1967 at La Coupole, the dome, even if the idea of a museum that will be created by the Casablanca School emerged since the year 1965 already.
And so just to mention, for now, we didn't find any photo of the one you mentioned in the Form and Symbol exhibition.
1967, yeah.
We don't have any photos.
But you have the poster here in the exhibition.
But you have the poster of that exhibition on one of the panels over there.
So maybe it's also something important to recall that the school was actually willing to create a museum since 65. As I said in an article, first goal of our museum soon to be opened, to protect and to raise up our artistic heritage on an international scale. So this was in 65. So just to talk about, as you said, Mourad, about the student work exhibited at La Coupole, which embodied the pedagogy of the school directed to the public space. The medium used by the student characterizes a pedagogy that blurs the boundary between the artist and the artisan, as also Fatim Zahra said earlier. The idea of producing in situ works is generalized by using the technique of the fresco. So maybe you can point out.
Of course, here we can see again the sort of more applied arts display of objects on a shelf system, which is not strictly put on the wall but combined with frescoes that you can see from different perspectives, very overtly done in order to create a kind of multiple optics system, you know, something clearly not still, but with a lot of movement, right?
Yeah, and there is also the wall paneling at the top of the wall, which is also quite an ornamental gesture.
Yeah, this part
made
here.
Made by Abdellah Hariri, which was also
this
a student at the time.
Even the structure of the space beyond the walls is invested.
So I will talk now also about the affiliation of the students' workshop, because in some cases, as Mourad said, it's quite evident to find whose artist was belonging to which studio. Like, for example, Malika Agesne's significant fresco that you can see in this picture.
This one.
Malika Agesne. She was, this work was actually produced at the Meleri workshop. And she confirmed this, belonging to Meleri's workshop, in an interview that she gave us during our field work that Mourad talked about. So, yes, some student identities, actually many of them, are still unknown. The apparent similitude of techniques and aesthetics between the unknown works presented in the exhibition and the work of the artists, of the professors, at that time, raised the question of the common aesthetic grounds the school worked on, allowing us to imagine a bridge between Meleri's workshop and Mohamed Sheba's workshop. For example, this fresco here. We actually don't know the author, like which student did it, but it's also quite surprising, or actually it really resembles one of the Mohammed Shabbat work at that time.
It couldn't be outside of Shabbat studio, right? Because yes, it's too similar to Shabbat's work.
Yeah.
But then we have to confirm that by interviewing 10 different people.
But actually, this reciprocity between the works of the professor and the work of the students was also something confirmed in the interview that we did. Because some former students talk about the fact that both Mohammed Meleï and Mohammed Shabbat was actually working during their classes on new paintings, and this new painting was also used as a pedagogical tool as an example. And we also know that Farid Belkaya even if he was a director, so he was not teaching. This is also something that we didn't say, but he didn't have his own pedagogical workshop, but he has his own private workshop, artist workshop, where he also created important works, including his copper works, that sometimes he did with the help of the students. No, I just would like to talk a bit more about the ceramic objects.
The ceramics. We can see some ceramics here, and also on the shelves, right?
Yeah. So these works were produced in the ceramic workshop held by a Swiss-born artist and ceramist called Mr. Ducaire, also contributed to the syncretism of the art and the craft. The exhibition, as we saw here, features works by the students, including two important artists who became important artists, Abderrahman Raoul and Zakani, that will be later in charge of the ceramic workshop also, while developing their own artistic careers. So the student choice to specialize in the ceramic workshop of Ducaire can sometimes be seen as a way to respond to strong dilemmas that they faced. Should they learn a trade in order to access to an economic future? Or should they follow a personal artistry path and taking the risk of the bankruptcy? So the ceramic objects nonetheless incarnate a third response to this dilemma while following the Bauhaus principles that Fatim Zahra talked earlier. By participating to the reunion of the applied and the non-applied art. So what we see here, it's a table composed of glazed ceramic tiles. There is in the center of the exhibition space. There is also different types of receptacles that we see on the top of the table and also in the shelves. And also some abstract sculptures. So these objects were a new typology of artworks intended to the social and to the public sphere. So these artifacts are also characterizing the principle of the school to use the popular arts as a model, thus affirming their status of artwork that has been denied during the protectorate. So Ducaire's studio departed from the Rada, which is a pot used to keep the water cool, as a model for the student to replicate. This is something that we saw also in the brochure of the school. So this student exhibition is a starting point to consider objects, both conceptual and physical, directed to the public space, produced by the artist professor, the student of the school, between 68 and 71. So now I will talk about the architecture. The figure of the artisan and the institute works need to be considered as effective strategies in the field of the art in the public space. As such, a significant collaboration between the artists from the Casablanca school, especially Mohammed Meleï, Mohammed Shabbat, and Farid Belkaya, and the architectural cabinets Farawi and de Mazière, Abdeslam Farawi and Patrice de Mazière, emerged from the Casablanca school in 67 already. So Patrice de Mazière and his wife, Pauline de Mazière, founder of the Pionier Art Gallery L'Atelier at Rabat, opened in 1971 and closed in 1991. First heard about the activity of the Casablanca School by the French cooperant architects Gérard Bauer, Jean de Thiers, and Bernard Amburger, who were well connected at that time with the cultural scene. So the couple, Patrice and Pauline de Mazière, met Mohamed Meleï and Mohamed Sheba at the school, and the idea of a collaboration between the architect and the artist immediately emerged. Sorry. The Casablanca School impulsed public art as the core of its curriculum and raised the question of the social responsibility of the artist in a post-independent society by emphasizing practices with a direct impact on the audience, such as, for example, public sculpture in the garden. We didn't see some of them, but it was also something that we found in this archive that we will use for the book.
Still under digitizing.
Yeah. And also public sculpture done in the Arabic park, which we don't have any pictures of. Therefore, the meeting with Patrice de Mazière and Abdeslam Farahoui played a very significant role by giving the means and the institutional frame to these initiatives. So, not even a year after they met, the architectural cabinet Farahoui and de Mazière commissioned new works to Farid Belkaya, Mohamed Sheba, and Mohamed Meleï, integrated into public infrastructure. So this is what we see here. We're not seeing all of them, but there were public infrastructure as university, as hotels, as factories, banks, and also hospitals. So the cabinet aimed to extend the integrated art practices at a national scale by introducing a cultural policy based on the acquisition of artwork for the public domain. Even in paradoxically, this art commission made to Meleï and to Sheba and to Belkaya were actually hidden. So I quote here, "The art commission were often done without the knowing of the foreman." So this could be paradoxical from the architectural cabinet, but it's to be understood in the general stake of a new group composed of artists and intellectuals from the Casablanca School, but also filmmakers, writers, poets, architects, public figures, whom their common ground was a critique of the institution and the will to invent new forms of sociability outside the elitist and private cultural sectors. So this same point led the new group of artists and intellectuals and architects through their cultural activities to use strategies, as we saw here, to substitute to the institution. So what we see here is the two hotels, actually. One hotel is called Les Roses du Dadès, and the other hotel is Les Gorges du Dadès, built by the architectural cabinet Farahoui and de Mazière in 71 and 72, in the south of Morocco, in the Dra region, at the east of Ouarzazate, along the Dadès River. There are two major constructions that illustrate the new collaboration between the artists and the architects. The art commission from Meleï for both hotels, this is what we saw here. So Meleï did mural panels in ceramic, this is what we saw here. And there is also a painting ceiling here.
The ceiling painting.
The ceiling, yeah. So this art commission illustrates the figure of the artisan. The objects were sometimes, as we can see in the picture here in the garden, produced with the complicity of the Casablanca Art School, even if for now we have no evidence at that moment that they were actually produced in the workshops of the school. So Meleï worked in series production, allowing distancing himself from the status of the work of art and introducing new functions and usages to the art in the 60s. Therefore, they were confronted to a new specification note where the artistic issues need to find a concrete application. This mural panel produced for the Hotel Les Gorges, were produced, as we can see in the picture, in 68. Yet the hotel construction started years later, in 71. So at this time, as Patin Zara recalled, Berfin introduced Mélanie to a rural pictorial tradition of the mosque and the domestic housing. So this new vocabulary of patterns, which are sometimes figurative, as we saw also in the film, influenced Mélanie in the construction of the commission by regard to his intention to consider the artwork as a whole. This wooden painting ceiling, which is in the Hotel Les Roses d'Adès, who again was starting its construction in 71, is a significant case study. Its immediate source is a painting ceiling mosque tradition, which Berfin introducing in 68. This is a more concrete example that we have of the application of a rural and popular tradition in a modernist vocabulary. Unlike the Casablanca school vision that intend to use the rural fieldwork as a new material for city cultural events, for example, the student exhibition, this project, hotel project, and the what we call the integrated arts, is about bringing the city into the rural and not the opposite and not the other way, and create for the artist a reciprocity between the fieldwork and the art experimented in field. So, following this intention to bringing the rural to the city and to the art, I will talk now about the exhibition, Agence Plastique.
Yeah, shall we just mention that this one is probably made by Sheba?
It's made by Sheba.
The large relief that we have here, just to follow the one that we learned about Mélanie. This is from Sheba.
And we can see here a mirror. Made and decorated by Adela Hariri,
who was one of the
students, and as Fatin Zahra said, he was also working with Mohamed Sheba in his interior design studio called Studio 400, Studio 400.
Sure.
So they were working together.
Okay, so the presence of these decorated mirrors by Hariri shows that even through the architectural collaboration, the professors would eventually bring over the students as well in those commissions, include them in a way or another.
Even at that time, he was no longer a student.
He was no longer a student. Okay.
He was working as an independent artist and graphic designer.
So they would probably not include students in architectural projects? Or
definitely not. Not that we know, actually.
Okay.
It was something they kept for themselves.
Okay.
It's also quite obscure at the moment.
Yeah,
was
not
actually
that we know for now, yeah, for sure.
Of Abdella Hariri is in also the student for Antoine. We still don't know if he was really working as an independent graphist or if he was actually assisting Mohamed Sheba to produce interior design. So we still don't know really
his
about the question of the authorship.
Authorship, right. Shall we?
But they're reclaimed as personal works.
Yeah.
I mean, the processes of creation, students, even if they were graduated at that time, have probably, there's a chance they helped. We don't know yet. But yeah, let's say the master kept his authority on the authorship.
So, yes, this is something that we'll conclude with.
Sure.
So this is the exhibition cycle, Présence Plastique.
Ah no, sorry. Okay, let's go to it. Let's go back to it. Sure.
Yeah. Présence Plastique, organized in the public space, aimed to build new types of audience by using different and sometimes opposed strategies of exhibition. Building a new audience for the arts become a major stake for the Casablanca School to distance themselves from the official art tendencies and the elitist salon. So the first exhibition of the cycle was held at Jamaica in 69.
This is the one we see here.
This is the one we see here. with works of Mustafa of Farid Belkaya, Mohamed Shaba, Mustafa Hafid, Mohamed Amidi, Mohamed Atalma, and Mohamed Meli. And it was aimed to create, as you said, and to connect with ordinary people living in the Medina, and also what they quote in the manifesto, the man of the streets. In 69,
a square which was still a highlight of the late Marrakesh Biennale, maybe for those who heard, who visited the Marrakesh Biennale since 2010, it's still one of the major squares.
So there is three exhibitions in this cycle. The second exhibition was held in 69 in Casablanca, so actually the same year, in a public square in the heart of the new city of Casablanca, and was exhibited the same artist, maybe the same works, we don't know. And in 71.
I mean, one of the things that we don't have, I guess, is a precise list of each artwork that were exhibited on Jama Efna or on the 18 November Square. I mean, they just circulated the venue from Marrakesh to Casablanca within a few weeks. We know the artist, but we don't have a precise artworks list, let's say.
Also, maybe something that maybe we should say is that for a very long time we didn't have any photographs of this exhibition. So it's really a new material that we bring.
Oh, I mean that we
with the exhibition also.
Of course that we brought together.
And the last exhibition, the third exhibition of the cycle, Présence Plastique, was held in two high schools, public high schools in Casablanca, Fatem Zahra and Mohamed V High School. And it was actually, there's just a small mistake, it was not in 69 but in 71, in 69 but 71, yeah. So 2 years actually later, the two first exhibitions of the cycle.
Are we sure about that?
Yeah.
Okay. It has to be edited, 71.
Sure.
It was published in
documented in the first issue of Antegra, which is 71, which we have there. First issue is over there with the flame.
So just to finish with this, because it's a bit outside of our chronological frame, is the Museum of Asila in 78. And we want to conclude with this because it's like find an echo to the cycle Présence Plastique. And also, so it's a public art festival created by Mohamed Meli and Mohamed Ben Aissa, where the Casablanca School find a new form, which is an associative form, because there were no longer teachers at that time of the Casablanca School. Farid Belkaya left his post, and so are the other teachers.
We have a few.
And with also new figures among the group, as a former student, Abdallah Hariri, Hossein Miloudi, that we saw, what did we see?
You can see Hossein Miloudi in the bottom left.
Hossein Miloudi, Malika Bizney.
All former students.
Who were also taking part in the Asila Art Festival.
Yeah. And also other artists that were actually not studying at the school at that time. That include Miloud, Elbit, Mohamed Kassimi, among others, and they were gathering around the original core formed by Belkaya, Sheba, Meleli, Hamidi, and Tony Marini.
Great, thank you so much, Miloud, for your presentation. Of course, you can join me in thanking our speakers. So I hope you'd like to ask some questions to our speakers, and feel free, of course, since we're talking about a quite uncovered issue, you know, to speak your mind about anything or any point of curiosity or any kind of question. I could ask, you know, so many questions, of course, but we're also very close colleagues who work on the same project and intensely debating almost daily about the way we are shaping this book, so it's definitely more interesting for us to hear of your questions than mine. So feel free for any questions that you might have. We can circulate the mic.
Thank you very much, that was really interesting. My question is about the frescoes in the, what happened to them? Were they just painted over, or did they stay there for a while?
That's a good question. So as far as we know, there was only one student annual exhibition in organized at La Coupole. So this is also something that we try to understand, why there were only one student exhibition. Even if before that, there were also some portes ouvertes, open doors of the school, where the student was showing their work in a small exhibition space inside the school. And about the
but nothing remains from that exhibition?
No.
No.
But the object remains.
The ceramics, maybe.
The ceramics and the panels, even if they are quite all of them lost today. but the fresco, yes, they didn't remain.
They were just covered.
Yeah.
Maybe they can be uncovered.
Maybe.
Imagine. If you can just scratch the walls and discover the student's fresco.
I don't know, that wouldn't be Morocco. I don't think so.
We have to go scratch the walls.
Yeah.
I think
yeah.
at this point we can even go scratch some walls to make sure that we don't find the fresco beneath.
But also, I don't think they considered that as artworks. It was sort of an ephemeral manifestation.
One time.
Yeah, there is really a manifesto dimension to each and every action of theirs. And this exhibition is obviously very important because it it comes at the end of 4 years of curriculum for the students. So it was a big project, and it was like an exam. So the temporality is different. But now when we talk to the former students that are artists, and we
some of them involved there.
Yeah, sure. And we dig up those memories, and today they can see the value, and they wonder why they didn't give them, where they could have gone. Yes, that's also the problem of conservation. Even archives, there is no archives in the school of Casablanca. There is a huge hole. They do have files of students since late 80s. Nothing exists before. Yeah, thank you.
Thank you, Karen. I have another question there.
Hello, good evening. Thank you very much for this talk. I was wondering about the women artists at this time, if there were any in this group that had a major influence or that we still remember today as a big interest in women artists.
We mentioned one, who is Malika Agzmai. Who is this fresco here? I don't know if you want to say a word about her or maybe mention other women whom I don't know. But she's quite
so the question was about
women
no,
artists.
The
and
was,
yeah,
woman
artists. Woman artists.
And as far as I know, it's Malika Agznay, but maybe you know others.
Yeah, there
Ahmed
is
Bolani's sister.
Yeah. So on
Ahmed Bolani's sister. Right.
Sorry, the name. Okay, Malika.
M-A-L-I-K-A Malika Agznay.
Agznay, yeah.
Which is
A-G-U-E-Z-N-A-Y.
You're welcome.
So yeah, it's known. We actually saw some effectively some women on the pictures that we find about the workshops, but very few of them made a career with their works. Even I would say that Malika Agznay didn't quite have the same career as the male colleague. So yes, this is absolutely a question. For example, in the picture we
and
that we have for a very long time, yeah. Yeah.
I don't know how to say it in English.
Sorry?
Elle est maître graveur, quand même. C'est la seule femme maître graveur au Maroc. Mm.
Engraver?
Yeah. Mm. She's master engraver and she holds her workshops in Asela. So, Asela's heritage is very linked to Malika Agnes' path, artistic trajectory. But there was a lot of amateurs within the school, like foreign students, women who came just to fill up their schedule and for the love of art and practicing creative activities. But Moroccan artists, not all of them. We only know Malika of. That's the only one we know.
Yeah.
Is there another question? Kenza?
Actually, it's more. I was wondering about the reasons why there was no teachers at some point in the 70s, I guess. And you talked about this turn to the association, associative world. Mm-hmm. And could you just tell us some elements, historical elements that could explain why the teacher didn't want to remain at the school?
So you're also basically asking why and how did they leave the school, actually?
And why the school didn't hire new ones?
So why this sort of very quite revolutionary time was interrupted, right?
Right. I also have another question.
Sure.
If that's possible. I was wondering, why did Maliki need an argument to kind of justify his choice of, of his motif, of his practice as a modernist practice? Why did he have to find something that was pre-existing in a traditional history or culture of Morocco to make the public more interested, or the critics maybe less critical? I don't know.
Okay, please answer the two questions.
Yes, of course.
So the first one is, is there any way to explain or to account for the fact that they, Sheba and Melehi at least, leave the school fairly early? They don't stay so long, even if Sheba stays a bit longer than Melehi, because Melehi lives in 69, and I think Sheba remains until 70.
He left at the same time.
Yeah.
Okay, they both left in 69. Yeah. I didn't do a mistake. So, just to account for the the time they leave the school, and then and then you will have the complex one.
So just to clarify a bit, there were actually no interruption per se in the school, because after Farid Belkaya left, they immediately hired a new director.
So Belkaya left in
74.
He arrived in 62 and left in 74.
Yeah.
Sorry, please go on.
So this is about the intervention part. But there was definitely a small revolution when they left the school. And about the reason why they left, it's very it's very various from the teachers. Some, for example, Mohamed Sheba said that he find difficult to hold in the same time a professional career first as an artist, and then he also had his interior design studio 400, and in the same time he's assuming his position as a teacher full time at the Casablanca school was maybe a bit much to handle. And Mohamed Melehi also said quite the same thing, because also his career was going further, and some also are talking about financial struggling at the end of the 60s. So this is a bit of the reason that we are in the fieldwork that we did.
Yeah, and there's probably also the ideological and political issue that we have to keep in mind, and how paths sort of diverged. And that's why we're also talking about groups within groups. So Berk left, Melehi was attempted by research and doctoral research in anthropology in Paris. Like, I think personal reasons and also that ideology that brought Shabbat, for instance, to commit within the context of Souf in a way that Belkaya Emilihi didn't. And there's also this history that we have to keep in mind. So,
And maybe mentioning that Shabbat was the only one who went to prison in a context when, for the dark years of Moroccan's authoritarian regime in the 70s, many of these intellectuals and artists who were experiencing the left as a political ideology and practice could go to jail. Not all of them went to jail, but maybe the fact that Shabbat was arguably the only one of the visual artist group to be jailed for a certain time also shows us, you know, the fact that they also had their particular and sometimes contradictory attitudes and trajectories tragedies and ruptures.
Many groups and histories and narratives within that big thing that we call the School of Casablanca, which is definitely not monolithic. That is why the spirit and the concept of Casablanca School as a creative notion and projection also is embodied in the publication domain and territories. Integral is the continuity of Souf. Souf is very much linked to Maghrebat as well. So there's also this story of the Casablanca School that we can read and try to dig up in publications as well. And there was another question related to why would Melihi want an argument or a reason for that. I think it has also to do with the ideological context at large and the artistic context at that time when Moroccan artists became their own modality. So I think it comes very simply to that question. I don't know, it's probably too binary in my head right now, I don't know, but that's the only answer I can give right now. Why we can need a reason. Yeah, I think they wanted to show that they could build their own modernity and their own language. And one way of doing so was to go back to cultural heritage. Also because at that time there is the dream of cultural revolution, this idea of reappropriating its own culture, and that was very, very present within the leftist sphere. But artists really embodied that spirit.
Thank you. Other question? I think we have a few minutes.
Me again, sorry. I just wanted to know, is it hotel is the open in the south of Morocco?
About the hotel?
If they're still open.
Ah, they are still open, sorry. That's a good one.
Yes and no.
Yes and no.
Yes, but not the same.
Yeah.
How can we summarize that?
Yes and no. So.
Yes, because they exist. Most of them exist. So yes. But
yes,
no, because they're.
Hotel in the south of Morocco.
And you travel there, actually.
Yeah.
You travel there to find the hotels back and document their presence. Most of them, you say, they're existing but abandoned, right?
One is abandoned, like Les Roses du Dadès in Klatangona, it's abandoned.
Like literally a ghost building.
Yeah, a ghost building. Another one was bought by a private entrepreneur that completely renew,
refurbished.
The space. So
got rid of all that.
But the one abandoned contains some of the visual artist work.
There is still the ceiling in the one.
There is still the ceiling. Yeah.
There's still the paint, the ceiling paint. Incredible.
For now, I mean, I was there 3 years ago.
It was
4 years ago.
3 years ago.
Oh, 4 years ago.
It
but maybe now they no longer exist. I don't know.
I'll check.
Okay.
And other pieces have been dismantled in Marrakesh.
They're not identified by Google Maps. Okay, shall we have a last question maybe? Otherwise, I wanted to leave some time also because in 15 minutes' time we would have to closely get out, but I'm also happy, you know, for the audience to have some time to interact with our guest beyond the Q&A. So if there's no more questions... one last question.
I was just wondering, when he saw a very... the ceilings and the old mosque and stuff. Do you know? I think you mentioned
the one we saw in the film.
Yeah, the one of those.
Was it a mosque or a simple house?
It's a mosque.
But those ones, I think, in the film, it said that they had not been sort of caught up by the by new forms of architecture or whatever it was. So do you know how old they were? Do you know how far back those ceilings?
I think we have an idea, right?
Constructions are dated back to the 17th century. But the painting itself and the artistic production is situated in the 30s, beginning 20th century.
Okay.
Which makes it very interesting for Bethlehem because he... he makes parallels with Juan Luis production and other modernist painters. He was
contemporary to the European abstract avant-garde. The contemporaneity in this case is super interesting.
Mm. And he's he's the most radical when it comes to that symmetry that he wanted to state and to make visible between Occidental modern art and those rural productions. Yeah. Whereas Melihi and other modern painters such as Picaya and all of them, they really maintain the value and the authority of the œuvre d'art and its aura and its superiority somehow on those productions. It was a source of inspiration, but I don't think they ever really raised it to the same level because they had to prove themselves maybe because there was this discourse of constructing and elaborating a validity of their own. And
at the same time, as you said, each of them had also his own perspective about it.
Absolutely.
Like Bert Flint has his perspective that he needs to create a museum. Melehi had his perspective that it's mainly a tool for creating a new iconography. Belkaria had his perspective that how it would come. So each of them also had their own perspective.
Yeah, own perspective and very...
There's also
specific battle as well.
There's also a fascinating debate which you taught me about that Bert Flint brings that Berber craft and popular arts more towards an Afro-Berber context, debunking the colonial line or border between supposedly North Africa and Sub-Saharan Africa, while Tony Maraini maybe was more into a Mediterranean inscription of those Berber and popular arts.
Mm-hmm. So there is this articulation between north and south, between high and low, and they really sometimes collapse and sometimes run one against each other in Maghreb art. But it's very subtle. Yeah, it's something that I'm trying to understand more and to articulate for the essay. And so two currents, one coming from north and one from the diaspora, and the migration of shapes and motifs from south.
Okay, so in order for you to save some time, if you want to meet our speakers, I'll just join me in thanking them once again.